David Epstein joins us on Sports Byline. David is a senior writer for Sports Illustrated. He writes about sports, science, and medicine, Olympic sports, and is an investigative reporter. And if you check out his work, you'll see he's co-authored several of Sports Illustrated's most high-profile investigative pieces, including the revelation that Yankees third baseman Alex Rodriguez tested positive for steroids back in 2003. But I invited him to come on because I want to talk about his latest effort, his book called The Sports Gene, Inside the Science of Extraordinary Athletic Performance. David, what was it that motivated you to write this book?
Really, it was my own questions from having participated in sports. So starting in high school, where track and field was a really popular sport at my high school because of sort of this mini Jamaican diaspora we'd had to our town, and we had all these great Jamaican runners, and I sort of started to wonder, you know, what are they bringing with them from that little island? And then I moved up to be a distance runner in college, and I'm running against Kenyan runners. Not only are they Kenyan, but they're mostly coming from one particular tribe, and I really just sort of started to wonder what was going on, you know. And so almost every chapter in the book is kind of one deep question that I myself had from either watching or playing sports that I then tried to answer with the best available science.
You know, when I took a look at the book, I thought to myself, interesting subject, but how does one go about researching it and coming up with any answers?
Yeah, that's tricky. I mean, for one, so I have an academic science background and was a national-level track runner, but it was really hard. I sort of, if you notice in the chapters, I sort of had to bite off one big question at a time and almost isolate each one in a chapter. And, you know, I spent a year before I even put pen to paper just reading 10 scientific journal articles per day, every day, just so I could even figure out what to sort of discard and what to kind of bring into the pile that might be interesting to talk about. So it was it took me a long time to do the book.
You say, in high school, I wondered whether the Jamaican-Americans who made our track team so successful might carry some special speed gene from their tiny island. In college, I ran against Kenyans and wondered whether endurance genes might have traveled with them from East Africa. At the same time, I began to notice that a training group of my team on my team could consist of five men who would run next to one another, stride for stride, day after day, and nonetheless turn out five entirely different runners. How could this be? Did you ever get an answer to that?
You know, I did. And actually, there's an anecdote in the book where I talk about me and my college training partner. I was a walk-on, very lightly regarded athletically. He was a highly touted recruit. And we would do the same training every day, stride for stride, day after day. And he would stagnate, basically, and I would improve every race, you know, like as if someone injected me with rocket fuel when the training started. And so he, you know, coaches and teammates would say to him, well, he's a head case because he's not improving. And me, oh, I'm this tough walk-on who's just outworking my training partner. But really, we were doing the same thing. And years later, of course, I get my genes tested for this book, and it turns out I have genes that predispose me to having a good response to endurance training. And that's really what we're learning now from exercise genetics is that talent isn't necessarily just kind of skill that precedes the ability to train, but how your inimitable biology interacts with a training environment. And so for me, I was what's called a high responder, even though I had a low baseline.
You know, you ask another question that I'm fascinated by. You say, are stars like Usain Bolt, Michael Phelps, and Serena Williams genetic freaks put on the earth to dominate their respective sports? What's the answer there?
They certainly do have unusual qualities. So you take someone like Michael Phelps, for example. So a long torso is really beneficial for swimming. It's just like the long hull of a boat. If you want to go faster, you need a longer hull. And Phelps is 6'4", and his legs are the same. He wears the same size pants as the guy who holds the world record in the mile, who's 5'9". So the runners have really long proportional legs, and the swimmers really short. That said, once you get to the top level, almost all the guys kind of have that. So then I think it's really their unique training plans that start to separate them. But before that level, people who don't have those very highly specialized body types tend to get weeded out.
You know, David, over the years, I've known a lot of great athletes, and I'm going to bring two to mind, and they're a little bit, you know, dated as far as older athletes, but Mickey Mantle and Yogi Berra both had sons that tried to play baseball, and I always felt bad for them because they were judged by the success of their parents. Yeah. The fact that they did not have the success that their parents did, or in this case, their father did, is that indicative of anything?
Well, as I sort of the question I ask in chapter one is why Major League Baseball players can't hit a softball pitcher. And it turns out that what I thought, you know, Major League Baseball players just had really fast reflexes. Then I scored faster on a reaction time test than Albert Pujols did. And I realized there was something else going on. And it's really, they learn perceptual cues from the pitcher's body, from the flicker, which is the flashing pattern that the seams make. And so you do want very good eyesight. But other than that, a lot of what goes into hitting a baseball is really a learned perceptual trait, not so much genetic as most people actually think. So to some degree, that might mean it's more difficult to pass down to children because so much of it is actually a learned skill.
Do we have to be careful about letting science get into this to try to come up with a definitive answer? I think every time we do something like that, we're trying to put things in their proper place, and sometimes you just can't do that.
Well, it's such a, you know, athletic skill and ability is such a complex phenomenon that requires, you know, motivation, which has its own genetic component that I discuss in the book, but support, opportunities, access, and the biology. So it'll never give us a full answer. But what I hope, since we are identifying more of these genes and tests are becoming available, is that we don't use them to kind of pigeonhole people saying, well, you should do this but not this. But instead, say to someone like me, you know, I was playing football and broke my arm, and that's how I tried track and learned that I responded to training well and it changed my life. Hopefully we can say to people, well, you know, you might be really good at this. You might respond to this training and do well and feel good and get positive reinforcement. You don't have to do it, but just so you know. So I hope that we ultimately use it in a way that creates more options for people, not to say to them, oh, well, you can only do this or you can't do that.
What about the racial discussion when it comes to sports and superiority? I mean, obviously, if you take a look around, the NBA dominated by African-Americans,
yeah.
The National Football League dominated by African-Americans. If you take a look at hockey, very few African-Americans. How does that come into play in this discussion?
Well, for hockey, I think it's very much the fact that they haven't had access to the sport. In the NBA, in some of the more explosive sports, it's not only, you know, we think of black athletes as dominating those sports, but it's really West Africans from a very small area in West Africa. If you look at, for example, you know, the Olympic 100 meters, which is the height of explosiveness, since 1980, every man who's been in a final in the Olympics, whether he's been from Portugal, Netherlands, Nigeria, United States, has been from descended from a small area of West Africa, where people tend to, on average, just on average, have a higher proportion of fast-twitch muscle fibers and long legs proportional to their limbs. That's an evolutionary adaptation for cooling when you're from low latitude. And so there are certain biological traits that cause them to be, you know, on average, a little better suited for certain endeavors. So when you look for the extremes, it makes a big difference there. And that's not to say people from other groups don't also have those physiologies. It's just you see an overrepresentation of West Africans from a certain area. And then sometimes I think that can become sort of self-reinforcing where other groups say, oh, well, I can't compete because you know, I'm not West African. And that, I think, is a mistake.
Does that apply to the female athlete as well?
It does apply. The female athletes have been a little more mixed because it's going in that direction. The opportunities haven't been quite the same. But as opportunities for female athletes in, for example, Jamaica have increased, they are becoming increasingly dominant.
I think you know as well as I do, Americans, at least on the female side in basketball, have certainly developed because of Title IX and the opportunities that women have had because of Title IX. How has that factored into this discussion?
Well, it's made a huge difference. I mean, so there was a period of time where when women started to have athletic opportunities that I write about in the book that, you know, there were some scientists who thought maybe they would overtake men in their skill because they were getting better so quickly, and some scientists sort of extrapolated that into the future and said, well, if they keep progressing at this rate, they'll surpass men, and that turns out actually not to be the case. So female athletes sort of plateaued in their performances, but you know, they've come an amazingly far way, and it's an unbelievable thing to see. And not only that, but in sports that were basically designed for male characteristics in mind. So women, when I looked at the scientific literature, always outperform men in tests of fine motor skills. But men have basically made the sports. So we really haven't organized any sports that would be conducive to women outperforming men, but we could.
We've got about 30 seconds before we have to break here. You know, the makeup of the male athlete, you've got ego, you've got emotions, and all of that compared to the female athlete. How does that factor in?
Well, so one thing we know about men, so testosterone is the main source of difference between men and women, and it's very, very responsive to environment. Men get a testosterone spike from playing on their home turf. They get a spike from basically having their ego stroked. They get a spike from being in a situation that simulates violence. And so men actually have very responsive hormone profiles to their environment in a way that women don't. So it's actually really important for men to create a certain environment in order to be most ready for a game.
This is a fascinating discussion, and we're doing it with the author of the book, The Sports Gene, Inside the Science of Extraordinary Athletic Performance. And that author is David Epstein, who has been a senior writer for Sports Illustrated, has written about science and medicine, Olympic sports, and is an investigative reporter. And when we come back on the other side, I want to get the definition of the 10,000-hour rule. We do that as we continue across the country and around the world with Sports Byline.